This is Unfiltered, episode 81 for January 15th, 2014.
The way we use the internet could change after federal appeals court struck down net neutrality rules. The judges believe FCC regulations over online content were overreaching. The decision opens a door for internet providers to block visit to websites. They could also slow down sites like Netflix and Google and even charge users for access.
On this episode of Unfiltered, this week a major blow was dealt to net neutrality when the court struck down the ruling preventing ISPs from abusing their monopolies and prioritizing some traffic over others. However, things might not be as bad as it sounds, so we'll dig in. On Friday, Obama is set to announce his reforms to the NSA. Today, the Presidential Review Panel testified before the Senate on their recommendations for reform, and we've dug through the reports, watched the testimony, and we'll arm you with the facts before the spin goes into overdrive. Then, it's your feedback, our follow-up, and much, much more on this week's episode of Unfiltered.
From the Jupiter Broadcasting Studios of News, Information, and Breaking News. I think I said that twice. Welcome again to another edition of Unfiltered, the show that brings you the news that you really shouldn't be watching on your television. I'm Chase Nunes, here alive and well, and Chris Fisher's with me as well.
Hey there, Mr. Chase. Good to have you back.
Hey, you know, this is my first show of the new year. Do you realize that?
No.
Because we did a show on New Year's Eve. We didn't do it on New Year's Day.
Yeah, we did it on Monday that week.
Right.
Yeah.
I wasn't here last week because of CES.
Right.
And so, finally, for the first time in 2014, I'm actually here.
It's weird. I didn't think of it because I feel like I just saw you.
Well, you did.
Because we had you on Linux Unplugged this week.
I was totally unplugged. I was laying down tux and we're having a great time.
Dropping the Linux knowledge.
I know. And I actually have a little bit of... Can you believe it? People don't realize that actually I know a little bit about technology and
gaming.
Well,
that might have been why you were going to CES.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. And you know what? I saw a lot of NSA equipment there. And it was...
No, those are just regular cameras and Google Glass. Did you see a lot of Google Glass?
You know what? There was probably the highest concentration of Google Glass in any environment.
Well, it seems like the perfect use case for Google Glass where you got a small crew, maybe you want to document something. That seems like the ideal Google Glass use case.
I thought of Unfilter all week, and I'll tell you why.
Oh, yeah?
So when I was out there in Las Vegas covering the Consumer Electronics Show...
I heard of it before, yeah.
It's a very, very small show.
Familiar with that.
They show off new gadgets and gizmos. Yeah. So we were staying, you know, at a hotel. You know, we'd flip on the TV and watch things, you know, from time to time.
Oh.
And the big, big phone company out there is CenturyLink.
Okay.
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 And they actually offer a television service out there.
Okay.
Over fiber.
Okay.
You want to take a guess? I should do an Ask the Chris. Do you want to take a guess of what their TV service is called?
Huh. I got nothing. I got nothing. What?
You're going to laugh. You're going to die.
What?
It's called Prism.
You're kidding me.
No. It's a fiber TV service from CenturyLink called Prism.
The name's catchy. You know, I got to give it to the NSA.
I bet you they had this like plan. I was talking with Joe about this. I bet you they had this plan like months, right?
Yeah.
Months in advance.
Yeah.
And then they launched this service and they're like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, remember,
no.
That's on your mic stand too. Remember, didn't one of those things say Prism on there?
Yeah, it's PRSM on here. Yes.
So I got something fun we're going to do at the end of the show. If we make it through the net neutrality stuff before the hour mark, we're going to go into the bonus round.
And
I've got two bonus clips that we didn't play in the pre-show that we won't get to unless we make it. And we might not make it. And we'll play it in the post-show so supporters can still hear it.
Okay.
There's some good clips. I think it's going to be fun. And one of them is the judge, and I think that'd be a good one.
Wait, is he back on the air? I thought he got fired.
Well, no. They just changed up the format of what shows he's on. And it's not as good. He's not on with Shep anymore, but, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, he should be on with Shep. Maybe they can give him his own tablet in the corner that he can actually
maybe he could just tweet, because I believe that's all they're doing in there. All right. Well, so, but first, before we get to the net neutrality stuff, there has actually been some really big NSA movements this week. In fact, on Friday, we're going to hear from Obama himself on supposed NSA reforms. However, to kick all of this off, there was a... you know this presidential review panel that was set up? Mike Morrell, former CIA director.
Totally neutral, by the way. You know, this is our government at work making us feel more safe and secure.
Your buddy Richard Clark is on there.
Oh, man. Right? I love Richard. Dick. And, I call him Dick.
Right, of course. Yeah. I call him DC. From DC, and so and a law professor and some other folks.
Merton Peoples.
So they sat down in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee today or yesterday. I can't remember the timing now. I watched it all on C-SPAN and recorded a few clips of their testimony, which I thought were pretty interesting and gave us some new information. So some of the stuff you're not going to hear anywhere else, I would assume, because unless somebody else was staring at C-SPAN all day. But what was interesting is sort of the overtone during this entire Senate hearing, and I think kind of pushed it in a certain direction, was a recent study that had just come out.
In the meantime, the NSA reform panel that is set to testify in a rare hearing before a Senate committee today on dozens of recommendations for the agency's controversial spying program. A lot of issues have been raised about privacy, and this move comes ahead of a big speech that the president will give on Friday, where he says that he will reveal his reforms and changes to the NSA surveillance program. This is a very big deal. But what about this? A new study claims that the NSA has basically done next to nothing to stop terror attacks.
Oh, yes, very much. Now, here's a little more about that review panel.
The Senate Judiciary Committee took on NSA reforms today, and they heard from President Obama's own independent NSA review panel, which recently put out 46 recommendations to reform the spy agency. Some ideas include adding more transparency to the NSA's requests for data from private companies, changing the NSA's leadership structure, and making changes to the top secret FISA court. Now, a lot of these reforms will require congressional action, hence today's hearing. And on Friday, the president will lay out which reforms he supports. But the most significant question today and the rest of the week is what happens to the NSA's bulk phone metadata collection program, which has been ruled likely unconstitutional by one federal court, but upheld by another federal court. The review panel discussed the privacy concerns associated with bulk metadata collection.
There is quite a bit of content in metadata. I mean, when you have the records of the phone calls that a particular individual made, you can learn an awful lot about that person.
The independent review panel also found no evidence that such bulk collection prevented any terrorist attacks.
So that's the official word. The review panel found that the bulk metadata collection did not contribute in any significant way to preventing any terrorist attacks. And they also admit that that metadata is valuable and that it is more than just, you know.
Well, yeah, what they want to do is they actually want to sell that information. So here, I mean, marketers love that stuff.
Here is the actual quote of Mike Morrell, former CIA director, admitting that in reality this metadata program has not been very significant.
Can you give us any specific examples of how metadata program was valuable to you when you headed CIA?
Press a button.
Senator, let me first say that... the reason I wrote the op-ed, particularly with regard to 215, is I felt that there was a misperception on the part of the media and much of the American public that the review group had indeed recommended an end to the program, and we did not do that. We recommended a change in approach. and that was the main reason I wrote the op-ed, is to make that clear.
We need to spin a new story. That's what we want to do.
Yeah, we didn't actually talk about this in a show that was on the air at the time, but we talked about it in the Supporters Only show. During like the ramp-up to the revealing of this panel's findings, Mike Morrell ran an op-ed column where he said, no, we're not saying that metadata should be stopped. We're not saying that. And I remember at the time we were like, isn't that a conflict of interest if he's just coming out and saying that? Well, now he's claiming, I wanted to make sure the story was straight out there.
It is absolutely true that the 215 program has not played a significant role in disrupting any terrorist attacks at this point.
But Chris, it might. So we need to continue doing this because we will catch the terrorists or terrorists.
It's an insurance program, Chase. An insurance program.
You wouldn't drive without insurance, Chris, would you?
Oh, I definitely would. All right. So he goes on to say that it hasn't. So he says, he just says it right there. It has not contributed.
Right.
Has not played a significant role in disrupting any terrorist attacks to this point. That is a different statement than saying the program is not important. The program, as I said in the op-ed, only has to be successful once to be invaluable. And it does carry the potential going forward to prevent a catastrophic attack on the United States.
Yep, see? Insurance policy.
And, that was another point I was trying to make.
This can't be used as a justification,
I believe it. Another point I'll make, Mr. Chairman, is that, and we talked about this
as a group.
It
needs to come back to the bare essentials. Is it legal or not?
Right. Well,
not legal. I don't care how you justify it.
So
it's illegal.
So okay. So if I'm following the logic here, even though this program, which is
be careful, you're following government logic,
is likely unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Which should be enough just on its own.
Right.
And really hasn't contributed to any terrorist plot being foiled in you know the 8 years that it's been running.
Right.
But yet it's still essential. This is where I'm not seeing the connection.
But you know what, Chris? It's still going to continue because it's an essential part of our acts against terror, even though it hasn't done anything.
There is value in a negative query of the 215 data.
This is an interesting concept, too. So the concept he's pushing here is there's value in not finding anything in there, too. So when we don't find – when the system doesn't help us find somebody, that's valuable, too, is what he's saying.
It's real simple. They just want the data, essentially. I mean, they don't care.
There is value in a negative query of the 215 data. So if you have a terrorist overseas who is talking about an attack and you don't know where that attack is going to be, it is invaluable to query the 215 database. And if the answer is that terrorist doesn't have any contacts in the United States, that gives you some reassurance that the attack will not be here.
So the exact quote is, it is absolutely true that 215 has not by itself disrupted, prevented terrorist attacks in the United States.
This really sets a dangerous precedent, in my opinion, because you can essentially say that about anything, right? You can say, we need to do this on the off chance.
Right.
That this could be a problem. Like, hey, we need to strip you down naked before you get on an airplane.
What if you took it just to the next level? What if you said, in another 20 years, 30 years, when we have maybe holographic storage or whatever, we have unbelievable computing power, and they said, we've been doing the metadata, but we have found that it would actually be a lot more beneficial if we had the actual recordings of the conversations, because then when the terrorists are plotting,
we would have
to
a clear picture.
We could just play it in court.
Yep.
There's our evidence right there. Case closed.
Yep, exactly.
And so really what we'd like to start doing is record. I mean, and you know what? This is just really good to have. It's an insurance policy because we can always go back and look at something somebody said too after the fact. So it's really good for a lot of reasons. But isn't that the – am I exaggerating, or is that not just the same logic applied to the next logical step in the overreach?
Well, what scares me is this is just the stuff we know about, right?
Yeah.
This is the stuff that is leaked.
Right.
It always wonders to me that – all right, we haven't heard everything from Edward Snowden yet. Obviously, we haven't heard the full...
What do you mean from Glenn Greenwald?
Yeah, Greenwald on the Snowden stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is once this stuff is announced, we're going to get another leak? We're going to get another big push of...
Maybe.
Oh, by the way, you didn't know this, but they're also collecting this from you and this from you.
We talked about the NSL, the National Security Letters and the Supporters Show.
Yeah.
And one of the things that this recommendation panel is recommending, we don't know if Obama is going to implement this yet, is making it harder, or at least as hard as it is to get a warrant to get an NSL. And it turns out...
It should be.
It should be, right?
Yeah.
But of course, even though there's been significant pushback from this, from like the FBI, it turns out there is actually still a little backdoor loophole where they could get the NSL without having to go to a judge.
Of course.
This is used to prevent an attack.
Because Diane...
So those of us that see it important to prevent another attack, I don't need to tell you, terrorism is up, groups have metastasized, we know they'll come after us if they can. There's a real litany here of fact.
Hold on. Let's play that again. Did you just say a litany of facts? Let's see.
A litany of facts.
Hold on, I gotta find that.
And there's a real litany here of facts.
There you go.
Yep.
So the question comes.
Yeah, she said that.
Do you not find value, substantial value, in being able to prevent this attack?
So again, she's like, don't you want to protect your country?
Substantial value in any tool that helps us prevent attacks.
This is Mike Morrell, former CIA director.
Yep. I believe that 215 carries the potential to prevent attacks, and that's why I think it needs to continue.
Now, 215 is their short term for the law that allows them to collect this metadata. So when they're saying 215, that's this part of the law that allows them to do this.
Yep.
But one of the important issues, I think, is the question of efficacy for us did not really impact our view on the change in approach to the program.
So the big complaint...
We do not believe that...
The FBI is saying that their plan to move the metadata back to the cell phone carriers and to the telco carriers would bring a great inefficiency to their program. And then having to get NSLs through a warrant process would bring another layer of additional inefficiency. That's the efficacy they're talking about. And so he's responding to that. Are you actually making him less efficient?
On the change in approach to the program. We do not believe that we're going to add a substantial burden to the government by making the changes we are suggesting. If something can't be done quicker than 9 days, then they need to make some changes to make that happen.
Now get ready for this.
We also wrote into our report an emergency provision so that in an emergency situation,
which will always happen, right?
Knows they need to move quickly, they'll be able to query the data without a court order going to the court after the fact.
So they'll be able to query the data without a court order.
What defines an emergency? Because
we're in a state of emergency right now.
Exactly. And doesn't it get renewed every single year? Since 9/11, I'm sorry, I dropped the 9/11 bomb. I'll ding myself. You know, it's been renewed every single year.
Yeah.
Without fail. We are under a constant state of war, an emergency, a war on terror.
So they still, after they use this emergency clause, then have to go back and report what they have done. But if you catch what that really means, and maybe here, I'll just play this. I'm going to play this last part again because this is really key, because listen to what he's actually saying. So he's saying they can query the data without the warrant, which means that it's not a technological blocker where the company...
It's a procedural.
Right. Yeah. It's not something where the company has to unlock it. It's totally procedural.
Yep. We also wrote into our report an emergency provision so that in an emergency situation,
which are now,
the intelligence community knows they need to move quickly, they'll be able to query the data without a court order going to the court after the fact.
I have a hypothetical for you, Chris.
I mean, we already know that there has been frequent enough cases where NSA agents have spied on their loved ones that they actually have a code called LoveInt for love intelligence when somebody gets busted for looking after one of their loved ones. Now, the only way they ever get busted is if they self-report, because there's also no auditing system in place.
Right.
So we have no auditing system in place, and it's only a policy, not a technological barrier, that would prevent these people from doing searches.
Well, there's no checks and balances for one.
Right.
And secondly, I was going to ask you a hypothetical. Here's a hypothetical, Chris. Can you name me a situation that would not be deemed an emergency? I challenge you to give me a reason.
Isn't every time you need to use a national security letter about an emergency situation?
Right. It is an accelerated situation that we need the information now because it's a matter of life or death.
Right. And we're going to get to what people actually predict Obama will implement. And by the way, this metadata change is not one of them.
No. Nope.
But your buddy, Dick Clark...
Dick!
I feel like he was trying to convey a message to the people who are paying attention. One of the things they asked him is, you know, when you were looking at this, did you look at other forms of surveillance that the government is doing? Because we have reports here, there's other types of surveillance that haven't come out yet, but it's all classified. And Dick Clark mentions that, by the way, there is an executive order that's been around for a long time that nobody's talking about right now.
The review, if I might, Mr. Clark, my last question... It looks at two authorities, Section 702 and Section 215. And these are both sections about which there's been a lot of public debate and discussion. But the review group also recommends greater government disclosure about these and other surveillance authorities it possesses. But the report appropriately and understandably does not itself disclose any additional programs. What review, if any, did the group make of undisclosed programs? Or could you at least comment about whether lessons learned from such review is in fact reflected?
We cannot confirm or deny those programs because we did not know about those programs because we don't need to know about them.
That would actually be what you'd expect, right?
Yeah.
And he actually says, by the way, there's this other executive order that's been around since Reagan.
12333.
Yep.
Well, I think there's a great deal of metadata collected by the National Security Letter Program, and we do speak to that in the recommendations. And there's also a great deal of communications. Related information collected under the Executive Order 12333. Public attention is focused on 215, but 215 produces a small percentage of the overall data that's collected.
I feel so good.
So all about all of this is to do about this metadata collection, which, by the way,
distraction.
This is a very small percentage of what they're doing, and so this executive order 12333, as Clark put it, is something that President Ronald Reagan signed an executive order on December 4th, 1981. And this,
so he just took office and he's put this in.
This is the powers in which PRISM has been enacted. So all of the internet collection happens under 12.
Before the internet really was around.
Well, this was amended later by Bush, and to kind of expand it there. It was amended, it's been amended on August 27th, 2004, and on July 30th, 2008. Presidential Bush issued Executive Order 1234702, amending Executive Order 12333 to strengthen the role of the DNI, which would be when they implemented the Director of National Intelligence to oversee that aspect of the PRISM program, right? That's what I would assume. I mean, that's an assumption on my part. But I would assume that when they were trying to clean things up...
Well, can't you look at that executive order? I mean, we can pull that.
Probably, but here's what I'm thinking. This is just my theory before we go down that route, is I think this was the Bush administration's cleaning up before Obama comes in, and they rearrange things, and they put this under the DNI, and this is now what they claim they have the legal authority. So I think when the PRISM program started, they were just kind of doing it rogue style. I think. And then they later had to make it fit to the legal system.
They had to solidify it.
Yeah, and so they used this old executive order from 1981 that's been amended by Bush a couple of times to make it all work. And so what Clark is saying in that quote right there is, hey, that's the one you need to pay attention to. In fact, I'll just play that last bit again. Because
he basically gave us a huge clue and carrot to what we really should be looking at.
Related information collected under the executive order 12333. Public attention is focused on 215,
but look over here.
215 produces a small percentage of the overall data that's collected.
Now, one of the themes you could probably predict, and I did not bother clipping all of them, 9/11 plays a role every time somebody's got to come up and say, well, if we had this during 9/11, wouldn't that have prevented everything, right? And so the way they got the panelists to agree to that statement was Dianne Feinstein Mike Morrell's op-ed where he said, in my opinion, this would have stopped 9/11. And then she read the whole part, like a whole excerpt from the op-ed, and they just asked in general if the panel agreed with it. And 9/11 was one of the things in that op-ed, but it wasn't all of it, right? So then later, 9/11 comes back up again.
You're making me hit this button. Every time you say 9/11, it gets a ding.
And this time, you could kind of tell, well, not everyone agreed that it would have done jack.
Senator Graham.
Let's pick up on what the chairman said. You wrote an op-ed.
Turn your microphone on.
Okay, there we go. Michael, you wrote an op-ed piece
for the podcast
that you think that this technology, if it had been in place before 9/11, could have helped prevent the attack. That's your personal opinion.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Morrell.
How many people agree with that? Raise your hand if you do.
Nobody does.
I'd say, Senator, that I think the reason we're not raising our hand is not that we disagree with...
So listen to this again.
If you do.
I'd say, Senator, that...
That's not raising your hand.
I think the reason we're not raising our hand is not that we disagree with Michael Morrell, but that we are not specialists in the details of 9/11.
Fair enough.
We didn't investigate.
Fair enough.
They did when I read it, she said.
They just said they did when I read it to them.
Well,
isn't this weird?
We'll just go with what you said.
We agreed with the quotation Senator Feinstein read from Mr. Morrell's Washington Post op-ed.
Oh, come on, let's just pretend like you all agree with that.
The 9/11 issue in particular, we
agree,
did not discuss
agree.
That as a group.
Can we all just pretend?
Okay, well, we'll take what she said. They agreed with you.
So that's the conclusion. Well, we'll just pretend like you all agree, because that just makes it a lot easier for the narrative that this would have stopped 9/11, when in reality, the Presidential Review Panel does not necessarily agree that it would have stopped it.
No, and, you know, it didn't. Obviously.
Right.
Because a lot of these things were in place during those times.
And in fact, your buddy, Dick Clark, later on says in the... And by the way, I have the full Senate hearing, if people want to watch this, in the supporters' sink for the show, for the, all of the notes.
Make sure you've had a few drinks first.
Yeah, it's long. But one of the things that Graham... Or I'm sorry, not Graham. One of the things that Dick Clark gets in at the end is we had information. It's just government agencies weren't talking. And that's what he says.
Well, yeah, they, you know, and we knew about that a long time, you know... CIA, FBI, you know, they don't exactly had a great relationship then.
Yeah. We got a couple more NSA things to cover before we run into net neutrality. Number one is Snowden has been quote-unquote honored with a new position. And
ooh.
Is it just me or is Jake Tapper a little butthurt?
It's another world news. Edward Snowden, the NSA contractor who took a treasure trove of the agency's secrets and leaked them to the world. He isn't a journalist, but he is a journalist's dream source, which is why today in news we're breaking right now on the lead, the Freedom of the Press Foundation is announcing that Snowden is joining its board of directors. Daniel Ellsberg is a co-founder of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. You'll, of course, remember him as the former U.S. military analyst who gave the infamous Pentagon Papers to the New York Times back in 1971. Mr. Ellsberg, thanks so much for being here. Why has the organization decided to add Snowden to the board of directors, even though he's not actually a journalist?
I don't know. Just something about the way Tapper says it. It's like,
I'm a journalist. I should be on that board.
Yeah, I'm a real journalist. I'm standing out here in the rain.
I went to school.
So if you actually thought about what Tapper is asking Ellsberg, you would see how stupid this question is, and Ellsberg immediately addresses it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not a journalist either. In fact, I'm a source, actually of exactly the same sort that Edward Snowden has been, and he represents the values, I think, of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, pressfreedomfoundation.org, which are that investigative journalism is essential to the First Amendment, freedom of the press, and of speech. You can't have investigative journalism in the foreign policy or defense, so-called defense area, without, put it very bluntly, leaks of classified information, because the secrecy system and the classification system have been so abused always that the information that the public needs to know to be the sovereign public and to have an influence on these policies is routinely classified, no matter what abuses that conceals. So he has acted. He's put his own life on the line, I would say. We admire him. I admire him personally very much. He's a hero of mine. And we're very proud, actually, to have him join us
Tapper
on
goes
the board,
off in three.
Which
no,
also includes,
two.
By the way, the journalists Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald, who have been the channel.
So they're also there with Snowden. Now, did you catch this story, Chase? This is I can't quite tell. This came from the New York Times a couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And I can't quite tell if the New York Times is just reheating up the talk that Jacob Applebaum had at the Computer Chaos Congress, or if they have new information. Now, the way they wrote the article would imply they have confirmed this information on their own. But you probably heard the story that the NSA is using radio waves to control software bugs in over 100,000 computers. Yeah.
Yeah, we talked.
I said radio waves.
Yeah.
And the NSA is finding new ways to spy on foreign adversaries and take on cyber threats through a program codenamed Quantum. The New York Times says the NSA planted software in nearly 100,000 computers worldwide. In some cases, the agency used secret radio wave technology to gain access when computers weren't connected to the web. The targets include China's army, the Russian military, and drug cartels. President Obama is expected to endorse reforms to the NSA in a speech on Friday.
Yeah, let's talk about that speech really quick.
On Friday, President Obama will spell out how he plans to overhaul the government's secret surveillance programs. Tonight, our Major Garrett has word on some of what the president's expected to say. Major?
By the way, hold
on. Good evening,
Scott. Can we pause it for
a quick moment? The White House insists
timing is everything in the news. Mm-hmm. I want to point that out. Typically, when you see news stories that are released on Fridays,
it's to bury the
lead. And then it always happens that way. Always, you guys, because by the time Monday comes around, no one's going to be talking about
it. Do you think that means Obama's not going to be announcing much?
No, I think what he's going to be announcing is a lot of reaffirmation that these programs are help keep America safe.
Yeah,
here's my prediction. Here's a Red Book prediction. He's going to drop the 9/11 bomb.
Okay.
During it,
you think really?
Yeah, he's going to say you know these programs been in. He's going to say something about 9/11. It's going to get in there somewhere.
Okay. All
right. I could be wrong.
All right, no.
But you know, it always works great for political parties.
Sure.
So he's going to drop that in there, and he's going to reaffirm that these programs are good.
You know what I'd be happy with? If he could somehow say, like, these programs helped us catch Osama bin Laden.
Wouldn't that be good. That's yours. It's yours.
All right.
So I say 9/11.
Yeah,
you're
saying
Osama bin Laden.
Yeah.
But the key, you guys, here, Friday. When you put out something on a Friday,
everybody's looking towards the weekend. They don't care about the news. They don't care about anything.
There is one possible kink in that is sometimes in the political sphere, not always because it's a little bit late. It's a late notice for the Sunday talk shows. But sometimes if something breaks on Friday, they'll analyze it to death on the Sunday talk shows. Not often because it's not enough time to book guests.
What time is he speaking on Friday?
I don't know.
Is it morning or afternoon?
That would make the difference, right?
It would be, absolutely.
I tend to agree with you. In fact,
I think the chat room's saying Friday afternoon. I'm just catching off.
In the remainder of this clip, they speculate as to what he's going to announce.
All right.
Good evening, Scott. The White House insists no final decisions have been made, but numerous sources tell us the president will preserve most of the existing surveillance technology and tactics, but will require more additional government oversight. In addition, President Obama will keep the storage of phone and internet data under the supervision of the National Security Agency.
I like
require
those phone
high
numbers.
Level administration approval for any surveillance of foreign heads of state, and add a privacy advocate to the secret court in charge of foreign surveillance.
Rubber
all
stamp.
This Scott in a speech Friday at the Justice Department.
Major Garrett at the White House, thank you.
Nobody's got a siren loop like those guys. I tell you what, Chase.
And when you have a guy by the reporting by the name of Major Garrett.
Right, that's pretty good. Although Chase would be a good reporter name, too.
Yeah,
you're chasing the story.
Yeah, I know, but major military,
yeah, I know,
you know,
I
it's
know.
Like
so,
top brass.
So it sounds like the NSA is going to keep the metadata.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's very powerful data, and it's great to have, and secretly to be able to research.
And if the NSA asks really nicely, they're going to be able to spy on world leaders, but they have to ask super nice.
They have to ask nicely, and we're not going to know about it.
Now, they did say they'll probably put a public advocate in there, so that could be interesting.
I said rubber stamp.
Yeah.
It's going to be a shill.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think you're probably
prove
right.
Prove me wrong.
No, I don't think I need to.
Yeah, I know.
All right, well, let's take a quick break and thank our Unfiltered supporters. So if you're new to the Unfiltered show, something you might not know is we don't take sponsorships.
What? In fact, what do you mean?
We actually turn them down.
Yeah,
and we
say
have turned them down because we want to be supported by our audience because we only want to have to report to you. And also,
hear about you.
We only really want to have to worry about the content. We don't have to want to worry about focusing it so that way advertisers want to buy or what we're going to sell to you guys.
Or we have to eliminate stories about certain companies because we don't want to feel like we're alienating them and... It gets complicated.
Yeah, I was actually thinking, like, for example, to your point, I was thinking a title that might work for this week's episode is Verizon is Killing the Internet.
Right.
Right? You would never, if this is a show we ever want to sell to sponsors, you wouldn't do that because even though Verizon would never sponsor this show, another sponsor, could be anybody, would look at that and go, oh boy, they're willing to put a company's name in the title
they
like
could
that.
Put, they could
that's
do this
risky.
To us.
That's a risky thing to take on. So we don't have to want to have to worry about that. We want to focus on the content. But the other thing is the only thing we really have to report to is the number of people who support us. We have to make content to those people.
Yeah.
And it fundamentally changes the way you put a show together when you're focusing on 300 people and what would make them really happy.
Yeah.
So what you do is you go over to jupiterbroadcasting.com, you pop any of the recent Unfiltered episodes, scroll down, click on the $5 a month button, and that keeps us on the air. We're trying to get to 330.
We're
getting close. Getting really
close. The great thing about supporting the show is not only you keep the show advertising free.
And on the air.
And on the air, of course. But you get some awesome perks, which includes a awesome downloadable pre and post show. So you get actually inside information, inside stories.
Additional clips.
About what we're talking about and things that are going on
in
our personal lives.
And on holiday weeks, we still have...
We still do it.
Still do shows.
We still do it.
Yeah.
We also, music, hijinks, and other things. You get a complete experience. But another thing, too, Chris, which is a very powerful thing, is that BitTorrent sync.
Yeah, we've got two of them. One of just the last five recent supporter shows. So that way you can just load that on your mobile device, and then it pulls down so super fast, and you play it on any media player you have on your phone.
Yep.
And then the other thing we have is the source code to our show. All of the files, all of the clips, all
everything.
Of the assets, notes, everything that goes into an episode of Unfiltered. And this, I think this folder's like 7 gigs now. It's since episode 54 when the NSA story broke. Everything's in there. So if you want to go back and look at the clips yourself, if we said something during a clip and you wanted to hear them say it again, you could go listen to your on your own. We have video versions of some of the clips that we play in the show. You can go watch.
And we make it really easy for you no matter where you are in the country. If you're on the East Coast, we put the investment back into the show so you get a fast downloaded connection.
We got a server on the East Coast to make sure that...
Yeah.
And that also helps with the
folks. And the West Coast, of course.
And since the way this BitTorrent sync works is, I feed it out to my two endpoints and then they feed it to the swarm and it just... People are
Boom.
Down downloading these files at the maximum speed of their connection. Yep. It's really cool.
Which is great. But only you can get it if you're a supporter.
And we also have the newsletter that goes out after every show. And if you just became a supporter, you get your first newsletter tonight. And that includes a regular straight MP3 download links and a place where you can go get the back catalog of the supporter show.
Now the great thing about the supporters, it's a low investment. And we have a great line of people who jumped on board this week.
So I'll start. I'd like to say thank you to Kyle T.
Vincent C.
And James M.
Matt B.
Matt C.
Christopher N.
Eric W.
You jumbled on that one. Well, Samuel.
You think that's Eric?
Yeah, that's Eric. Yeah. Samuel B.
Philip S.
Tony.
Bobby C.
Seth.
And of course, that would be Adian. Adian M.
And Sean Z.
And then TZ. That's why I always just call him TZ. He's a long time.
And by the way, I said Zed for all our UK people.
Oh, nice. Our Canadians. They appreciate the Z too.
They do.
So that brings our total to 328 subscribers. Now, when we get to 333.
What happens then, Chris?
That magic number covers the day of production. And you know, let's be honest, this is not one day of production. That's why I kind of. It's just a really kind of easy way to say that. But this show really starting the day we go off air, but really heavily starting Sunday night after the Linux Action Show, I start collecting clips. And really, it's a multi-day process to put the show together.
Yeah, no, it is. You have to, unfortunately, sit down and listen and watch C-SPAN.
People who grab the source to the show, they start to realize. Like, they start to see. And it's because, you know, like that C-SPAN thing where we pulled some of those clips, we might be the only place some of these people hear those, because that's not playing on the news, right?
No.
And the thing is like, that was hours of just listening to boring C-SPAN crap. Yeah. And that whole video now, if like you're the kind of person that does like to see all of the little nitty details, see how people talk and all that kind of stuff, that whole video is in the supporter sync, and you can get that.
And when we do this, to provide you with the information to say, hey, feel free to fact check us. Form your own opinions. Yep. Listen to the content itself, the pure content that's not been edited.
We don't say this enough either, but and this is just up on the website. The show notes also have additional links to stuff we talk about. Sometimes stuff doesn't fit in the show, and that's there too. All right, well, why don't we shift gears to net neutrality? I think this is something that you and I, because we're content creators on the web, we have kind of a big opinion on. And net neutrality, there was some laws that were passed in 2010 that sort of set up some rules.
Well, they weren't exactly laws, though. And that's the one thing we have to be specific about. These were regulations by the FCC that they enacted to say, and it was a very narrow decision, but they enacted them to basically try to keep the internet free of companies trying to
give preferential treatment.
Right, set up different speedways and that sort of thing.
All right, so let's recap what happened recently.
A U.S. appeals court has struck down measures enforcing net neutrality, or equal access to all online content. As a result, broadband providers will soon be able to navigate users' traffic and steer it toward or away from certain websites. The ruling followed a lawsuit brought by one of the largest U.S. mobile phone operators, Verizon, against the Federal Communications Commission. The company challenged the FCC's ban on providing extra bandwidth to certain websites on the basis of commercial deals struck with them. Civil advocacy campaigner Todd O'Boyle says the preferential treatment of some internet services at the expense of others jeopardizes the future of the web.
I think the biggest implication potentially is for content providers and for innovation. We know that the innovation has flourished online because small players have had equal access to consumers. As of this ruling, a big company like Verizon could strike a deal with a video service and make a partner deal with them so that their content would always be delivered more quickly. That makes it difficult for the next startup to get started. If that decision is left unchallenged, then there's nothing really stopping from an internet service provider from blocking access to specific content. And if you block access to the most important online social organizing tools, it may impact what they're able even to say and how they can connect and communicate. So absolutely, there are startling free speech concerns here.
I'm not going to lie. I feel like I got a little skin in this game because what if...
We all do.
So let's take you and I both have a common situation right now. Matt's suffering this too. We all have the same Fios internet service.
Yep.
And we are currently getting screwed, even though we have really fast connections to our house. there is an office in a town close to us called, what, it's Bothell, right?
It's Bothell, Washington.
And in Bothell, where they have some routers, they're having massive congestion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, they, you know, they've been advertising and pushing their service. More customers have been coming online.
And it's, you know, it's understandable. If you have people at the endpoints who have 50 megabit connections, they're going to be able to throw more at your central routers because they're going to be, it's going to be just more traffic.
You just can't throw another little Linksys in there, though.
So you could see how Frontier would go, all right, well, look, Mr. Hastings, if Netflix pays us $3 million a month or whatever, or a year, or $100,000 a year, or whatever it is, or $2 per customer, then we will put you on the new router that we are implementing right now that, you know, we're looking to sort of cover our costs on. So, because right now we're looking at our traffic stats and about 70% of our traffic after 5 p.m. is Netflix. And so really it's your traffic that's congesting our network and making the service for the rest of our users
but
poor.
But here's the thing. A lot of people don't even realize Netflix is already paying a provider. They're already paying to get their content out there.
Right.
Okay. They have servers that they have to push the bandwidth outbound
Netflix has a
they have home, their drops.
They have they have their home rolled CDN. But so that's one example. But what about us?
Right.
So what if companies like Amazon and Google and Netflix for, you know, Google for YouTube could pay to be on that new router?
Because they have loads of money.
And you and I couldn't. So you
we're
have
on
this,
a second tier.
Right. We have where if you go to stream an episode of Unfilter, well, that takes a while to buffer, right? But if you go stream an episode of Archer on Netflix, that starts instantaneously.
Yeah, but you know what, though? While this is very fearful, I think these kind of situations, when the regulations were put into place, a lot of the regulations were more geared towards the wireless side of things than they were towards the actual landline sort of thing. And the companies like Verizon wanted, and also AT&T wanted to do this, hey, free data if it's sponsored.
Yeah, so AT&T's launched sponsored data now.
Right, but
so isn't this the same thing in reverse? So
but that's only over wireless though at this point. Right.
Well,
but what I'm saying though is the regulations were really obviously geared towards keeping it all wide open and free. But you have major groups.
Well, it's sort of the regulations forced them to keep it a level playing field, right?
Right.
So the regulations were only applied to wired lines, whereas in wireless, they said, have at it, Haas. You can manage your network however you see fit because wireless spectrum is a limited resource. And if you recall back, Google played a key role in this deal. Do you recall this?
So I do.
Google flipped on the wireless thing, and they said, okay, well, if we can get an agreement on the wired, we'll stop pushing on the wireless aspect of this and have at it, Haas, on the wireless. And then, as long as we can keep net neutrality on the wired, we, Google, are happy. Well, now look what happens a few years later. That gets repealed.
Well, you know what, though? Who's got more money than God right now? And that's Google, right?
No, that's actually Apple.
Well, all right. Google and Apple. But see, Apple also has a play in this game,
too. Well, so does Amazon.
Everybody does.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think you're going to see them play it, hopefully, if they're playing it smart, they're going to play it for the consumer.
But the problem is if you have a scenario where you have sponsored data, and you can be, if Google even takes 2% of their ad revenue on the YouTube videos and helps pay for users' data, Google already deploys Wi-Fi in airports just so people can get internet. I could see Google being willing to do subscribe data. So if you're on AT&T and you watch YouTube, Google pays for that bandwidth, and it doesn't go on your bill. Well, and then if you go to Jupiter Broadcasting, you do pay for that. So what you're actually doing is you're incentivizing the user not to watch Jupiter Broadcasting because that's data you pay for. But if you watch YouTube, that's free.
Well, the worst thing about all these situations is when you have companies like Verizon and AT&T who are not only ISPs, but they're also content providers. Because remember, you guys,
Verizon's got their own Netflix.
Verizon, actually, not only they have their own Netflix with Redbox, but they have their own TV content network. They have, you know, Fios TV. Also, AT&T has their U-verse technology. Frontier has their own television service as well. So everybody has a part in this game. However, I truly still believe in the power of people. I know I'm old school, but I really believe that if people were getting, hey, you pay $60 for power, or you pay $60 for water,
well,
your water isn't segregated depending on what your water is. Data is data, isn't
it? I actually think that's a really good example. So where we live, we have the distinction of being able to choose between two ISPs.
Three, technically.
Okay. But we don't get to choose between power companies and water companies.
Now, one of the things that's different, though, here, in at least in our county, is we're a public utility district.
So a lot of places...
Not-for-profit.
Don't have... In fact, this has been one of the biggest comments I've seen into the story is...
They don't have selection.
They only have one ISP in their area. It's an actual monopoly.
Yeah.
And so if that one ISP decides to do this, it's not like the free market has no recourse. There's no recourse for the free... There's no corrective action that can be taken.
That's right.
So I think in the absence of market conditions that allow for free competition to sort these things out, there has to be some sort of regulation on the internet in terms of prioritizing data.
Wouldn't also possibly, I mean, I know it's hard, and you've seen companies try to do this and fail because these incumbent companies have come in. I think that this is a chance on the state and local levels of government to come in and say, hey, look, you know, remember, a lot of cable companies and ISPs have to negotiate what they call franchise agreements with cities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you know, let's say, for example, a city, for example, wanted to start up their own fiber network. And the city, obviously, they're going to listen to their citizens, usually local governments, you know, much more receptive to the citizens. They could go to the citizens and citizens go, hey, look, Verizon or Comcast, if you will, is setting up tiered internets. I don't want that. I pay one cost. I want an unrestricted internet.
Yeah.
So I want you guys to form your own internet. I want you guys as a city to have your own fiber connection. And then they're going to say, well, wait a minute. We don't want that. So part of the condition of a new franchise agreement could be, hey, you have to have an unrestricted internet to this community.
Yeah, it could work through that way. It just seems like even in that scenario, you're relying on a lot of people to be a lot more informed than I think they actually are.
Well, if they notice that they can't get to their websites or they notice that certain secondary websites.
Well, what they'll notice is the name brands are fast and the little podunk guys are slow.
Right. And they're going to ask why.
I don't think so.
I think they would.
I think they'll just know, well, if I want good quality performing speed, I go with a name brand.
Right, but what I'm saying is, hey, Comcast, why is it that I can't get to this site correctly? And they're going to tell me. They should tell me, right? Wouldn't they tell me?
I don't know.
Wouldn't that be public info?
So it's not all bad news for the FCC, though. Even though their regulations got repealed, the court left part of the open internet in order intact, saying that the FCC still has the general authority to require how broadband providers treat traffic. So they actually might come back with something else or even appeal this. But this isn't horrible, horrible news. And Tom Merritt has a new podcast called Daily Tech News Show, and he covered this on there. But I actually thought his best summation of what's going on right now and where we're at was a spot he did on the morning stream this morning.
The internet exploded yesterday.
In all seriousness, the internet did explode. U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit granted that the FCC has general authority to regulate how broadband providers treat traffic, which is a victory for the FCC. That's getting overlooked by a lot of people here. The court did affirm, like, yeah, you get to regulate broadband providers. Broadband providers would have liked that to have been thrown out, saying, look, the FCC has no business regulating us. We're not a broadcaster. We're not this or that. What the court narrowly said, and this is where I think a lot of the confusion comes in, is that there were two rules the FCC had put into place as part of their open internet order, and it only relates to the wireline broadcasters, not wireless broadcasters. That's the folks that, you know, let you plug an Ethernet cable into things. The two rules were that they could not block lawful content, application services, or non-harmful devices. And the other rule was they may not unreasonably discriminate in transmitting lawful network traffic. Now, those seem like very reasonable rules. The court said they are very reasonable rules. The problem is that back about 10 years ago, the FCC decided that they were not going to regulate broadband providers as a common carrier.
Mm.
And the reason for that was they wanted to promote innovation and investment. Mm. So they said, we're not going to regulate you like a phone company. We're not going to make you be dumb pipes. We're going to let you just go out and do what you want. Well, we've all seen the great effects of innovation and investments that the ISPs have been making since that ruling. But what the court said, and the court's right, is, look, if you decided they're not common carriers, you can't regulate them as a common carrier. And under the Telecommunications Act of 1996, it specifically prevents you regulating a service as a common carrier if it's not classed that way. And these two rules seem to be regulating them as a common carrier. So we're going to strike those out and you have to go redo your process, either reformulate the rules so they aren't so common carrier like, or reclassify the services as common carrier.
Mm.
If that's the case, if it's that simple.
It is, yeah.
So why don't we, I don't know, as Americans, we have this petition, what is it, petition.gov or whatever,
right, yeah.
Whatever hello everybody's website is. We could go there. You get 100,000 people. That's all you need, right? $100,000 for a response from the White House?
For a response.
And let's get a freaking law passed to make them accountable.
So now we're kind of in this weird like middle zone. So it, as Ars Technica put it, the FCC screwed up their chances to do this back when they did when they set all this up. As Tom said, because they were regulating them as common carriers, but then they themselves said they were not common carriers, ergo they couldn't use those regulations. Now right. The thing is the current FCC chairman, he's not so sure this is anything he really is going to get too worried about at this point. His philosophy is based on some digging that Ars Technica
remember
did.
By the way, he's a former industry person, people don't
right.
forget that.
Good point. And his take is, according to Ars Technica, is, well, let's, you know, let things work out. Maybe we'll see some of these carriers experiment with different things, and maybe some of these things we'll like and some of these things we won't, and then we'll kind of figure out what we need to regulate, which kind of sounds like a way to kind of just let them have at it for a while. And this, I think maybe I'm a little extra sensitive to this because years ago I read, back in 2010, a book that I love so much that year I got it for a few members of my family. It's The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. I'm going to play a little clip of it right here.
Visibly stunned. It was a latter-day miracle, reported the magazine. The human voice was speeding from ocean to ocean, stirring the electric waves from one end of the country to the other. The grand finale was a demonstration of Bell's newest and perhaps most astonishing invention yet. A wireless telephone, the ancestor of our mobile phone, of which, by 1916, Bell already had a working prototype. To show it off, Bell mounted what might be called one of history's first multimedia presentations, combining radio, the phonograph, the telephone, and the motion picture projector, the most dazzling inventions of the early 20th century.
So he goes back and looks at major innovations in everything from the phone to cable TV, radio, the telegraph, and now the internet, and shows how when they all started, they were this amazing brand new thing that was going to allow human-to-human conversations, that was going to bypass the middleman, that was going to bring a new era of information and enlightenment to the human race. And as time went on, they eventually all get kind of locked down to industry, to the incumbents. And then it's a cycle that repeats. A new disruptor right. comes along, like yeah. TV to radio. And then it's all over again. Then cable comes along, and it's et cetera, et cetera. It's a good book. I'll link it in the show notes if you guys want to check it out. It gives you a lot of perspective about where we're headed with some of this stuff. Have you heard of Master Switch before?
No, and actually I might check that out. I do have a question for you, Chris. I mean, mm-hmm. I know we tend to be sometimes pessimistic on this show.
Who, me? No.
I mean, sometimes.
No.
What do you think the end game here is? Obviously, well, I mean, do you agree right now with the FCC chair that let's see how things work out?
Well, I guess it's our only choice.
No, it's not. I mean, we could rise up against the machines and fight them.
Not going to happen. No, didn't you know Duck Dynasty's back this week? Can't be bothered. I think in some regards, peer-to-peer protocols will help negate some of this because people just all over the world will seed things and that'll help. And, you know, they won't be able to apply pressure directly to things like CDNs because we won't be using CDNs. And so more people move that direction. But it's not entirely a technical problem. There is a legitimate political problem where we have to work with the system to make sure this is right. It would be a shame to take a crap on the internet. It really would be, because it is a great tool for communication and informing people.
Well, not only that, but as we heard, and how it is still today, everybody's equal right now on the internet. There is no preference. You know, obviously there's preference in search results, there's preference in a lot of things.
Yeah.
But all matters
in terms
same.
Of like data line preferences.
Right.
We all get the same shake.
Yeah, we are all the same.
Yeah. All right, Chase. Well, guess what? We unlocked our bonus round.
Oh, yes.
All right, Chase. It is, since you unlocked the bonus round yourself, it is your
yes.
choice.
All right.
You get either a Judge Napolitano NSA spying rant or what do the weak job report numbers really mean for the U.S.
economy?
Oh,
God, this is a tough one.
I know. It is a tough one. In fact, if you want, I'll play a little suspenseful music while you try to decide.
Well, you know, usually I'll think about it and just say it out, but, you know, it wouldn't be fair because you guys can't read into my mind.
Right.
So as you guys know, right now I am unemployed. And, you know, I'm not surprised by the weak job numbers because, I mean, go figure, there's a lot of people out of work.
But we just got done hearing all this great positive news about the jobs and the economy. In fact, remember, it was so positive, the Feds came out and said, I think we're going to start tapering now because jobs are doing good.
Yeah, jobs are going great.
But all of a sudden, new jobs report came out, only 74,000 jobs created.
No, I'm not shocked by that. And we always love the judge.
Yeah, he's always got that constitutional perspective, Chase.
Yeah, well, you know what? Jobs is very important to me right now. As much as I love the judge,
you want to go
to the jobs.
All right, here we go. What do weak jobs mean for the U.S. economy?
Today, we got the first unemployment report of the year. It shows the unemployment rate falling below 7% for the first time since the Great Recession.
Now, Chase, why do you suppose the unemployment rate has fallen to 6.7%? It is the lowest it's been since the Great Depression. Why do you suppose that might be, Chase?
Well, because a lot of people stopped getting counted.
The economy created only 74,000 jobs last month, the worst showing in 3 years.
Oh,
is with us tonight. Anthony, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
Bad weather appears to have played a big factor in.
Processing what this guy just said?
Wait.
Are you processing what this guy just said?
You're going to have to freaking censor me here.
Are you ready for this? Well, I just want to make sure we heard it. Okay.
Bad weather appears.
Okay. That's a metaphor, right? He's not going to go on and talk about because of the cold snap that's just a metaphor. You know, it's like there's a bad storm brewing. A metaphor.
Storm in the jobs market.
It's a metaphor.
But that would make more sense.
You know what? This is a metaphor. Yeah.
Scott, bad weather appears to have played a big factor in December hiring. As one economist put it, job growth got snowed in.
The drop in the
unemployment rate looks good, but the biggest factor was people dropping out of the workforce. We met one person today who is trying not to do that.
People tend to blame themselves to begin with, but in reality, it really is the fact that there's not enough jobs out there for everybody.
58-year-old John Fugazi's been out of work for more than 15 months. He's lost his house and had to move in with his mother. Not long ago, he was running a frozen food department for a supermarket chain. Now he's job hunting in a New Jersey library.
Quitting isn't an option. So no matter how hard it is, if we give up, what's the option?
But more and more Americans are leaving the workforce. Fewer than 63% have a job or are actively looking for work. That's the lowest level since 1978. Economists cite three main reasons. Aging baby boomers are retiring at a growing rate. The poor economy is keeping students in school longer. It's also discouraging job seekers. Many have just given up looking. But John Fugazi isn't there yet.
The only way you can have hope is to keep at it. I mean, let's be honest, that's what America's about.
The weak job growth stunned economists.
Stunned.
It may have been the weather, but it may also make the Fed take a second look at cutting back on stimulus.
Anthony, thanks very much.
Can you believe this weather crap?
Can you describe the look on my face to people,
shock,
Chris?
Shock, I would say. Chase, it may have been the weather.
The weak job growth stunned economists.
And economists were stunned, of course. Now, it's funny because you and I are not that stunned. I kind of saw this one coming. The only thing that stuns me is they're blaming it on the weather. Because, like, we both said, of course. And what's crazy, and I'm no Mr. Economist over here, but if you don't have a lot of jobs in the month of December, that seems like a bad thing, because isn't that when a lot of people are hiring to cover for the holiday rush?
Yeah.
Isn't that traditionally a high jobs number?
The only problem is typically the majority of those jobs are temporary.
Right.
I mean, obviously Amazon,
but,
UPS.
But doesn't that, but I'm so used to an end of year
goosing. I am blown away by that.
It's like an end of year goosing of the numbers, because like, oh, we ended on a high note. Well, of course we did, because we ramped up temporarily. And then usually January and February, it's like a train wreck of job numbers. But no, we got it in December. We got an early Christmas present.
You know, everybody's been following my trek to find full-time employment. Does Chase have a job yet? .com.
Can I ask you something, Chase?
Yeah, Chris.
Has it just been too cold?
I'm at a loss. that really severely pisses me off.
Yeah, they gotta brush it under the rug. You know, they gotta.
I mean, you know,
it's not a big deal.
I have done everything. I think I've done everything I can. You know, I've reformulated my resume countless times. I've reformulated my LinkedIn page countless of times. You know, all these things. And I truly believe that, you know, you have to incentivize companies for building jobs here. And, you know, obviously, I look at this as a great example. One of the biggest examples I can ever give is look what Boeing and the state of Washington did. So the state of Washington gave Boeing, a large multinational company, huge, I mean, record-breaking tax breaks to bring jobs and to bring the manufacturing of the new 777 and its wing to the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. They provided that. They provided that, okay, to incentivize that company to bring those jobs here. Well, a lot of other companies are not extended out those same benefits. Right. A lot of those companies, even small employers, are taxed to the hilt, you know, because the states do that. So there's, you know,
there's a lot of reasons.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons there. So it's one of those situations where
I also think they blame. I feel like they lean on this people have given up meme. Like, I guarantee you that does happen because people just get so frustrated. But I bet like they exaggerate that. Well, they're not counted because they've given up. And I think it's almost like an excuse not to count them anymore, right, in a sense.
And you know, the worst thing about this whole ordeal is that obviously there are some people that love you know, living off of unemployment and, you know, don't want to bother with going in and getting a job and working hard to make a difference. And, you know, for example, if McDonald's paid me $15 an hour, sure, I would go work at McDonald's. But the you know, working at McDonald's doesn't like in the chat room, I it was I Am Icon, I think, who stated, you know, he expects me to go work, or she, I don't know if he or she, expect me to go work at McDonald's. Well, that wouldn't make a difference because I could work at two different McDonald's jobs and still not bring in enough income to pay my mortgage. So what's the point?
Yeah.
What's the point in trying to do that?
Right.
You know, my number one goal is I will take a lesser income, sure, to pay the mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, you know, and survive. That's my only goal. Yep. That's, you know, so. And
so it's not the weather is what you're saying?
A.
Not the weather.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That is ridiculous.
Crazy, huh?
That is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you picked that one. That was a good one. I mean, the judge had a good rant.
I know, but yeah. I'm pissed. Sorry.
Well, I got something that might cheer you up, Mr. Chase.
Yeah.
A little good news. You predicted back on episode 79. So while you pull up the subreddit, I want to give a special shout out to, let me see, back in episode 80, Giant Duff predicted that we get at least 320 new supporters, and I think we're at 328.
Oh, so we're doing a prediction of supporter.
Well,
numbers.
He decided.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
In lieu of your subreddit prediction.
All right, so subreddit prediction. What was my prediction?
In episode 79, you predicted we'd be at 1,075 unfiltered.reddit.com.
You know what sucks? You know, I should really get a job in trying to make predictions because. Because if I got a job doing that, I would be mildly successful.
Oh, no. Really? That's good.
We reached 1,093 supporters on the Unfiltered subreddit.
Nice.
The great thing about it is that is your way to speak back to us.
Chase, what do you want to make a prediction for next week?
Man. You know what? I'm going to be modest. We're going to break the 1,000 plateau. So we're going to, or the next 100 plateau. So 1,100 readers.
All right. 1,100?
Yeah.
All right.
That's my
goal.
I got
it in the book.
Now, Chris, obviously during the course of the week, you like to share your thoughts and.
Could I give it to you in 140 characters?
If you can on this service, though.
Twitter.com/ChrisLAS.
Berkeley Linux
Check it
Action
out.
Show.
It's new.
Yeah, it's new. It's brand new.
Yep. And they're only doing 140 characters. This their thing.
Totally.
What about you? Like, maybe you got some new CES videos coming out?
Oh, yeah.
I've
been tweeting up a storm.
Where should we follow you?
Follow me on the Twitters at Nunes. N-U-N-E-S. And all my CES coverage is at geekgamer.tv. Posted. We got about 7 or 8 different segments.
Including you just put one up on that new...
Project Christine.
Yeah, that
it's
new
so
Razer
sexy.
PC.
It is so sexy.
That's really cool.
I got to touch one of the modules.
Nice.
Yeah, I touched it.
Now, don't forget, we want to hear your feedback, so go to jupiterbroadcasting.com, pop that contact link, or get a hold of us in the Unfiltered subreddit, or even better, join us live on a Wednesday over at jblive.tv. Go to jupiterbroadcasting.com/calendar to get that in your local time.
Yeah, and you know what? I got to say, you guys, thanks for joining us. It's great to be back in the year. We'll see you right back here
next week.